once again, we have Martin Weiner on the line today, and we're going to at least initially start talking about his article Awareness and Functional Integration, which is from the Feldenkrais Journal in 2006. It's also online at utahfeldenkrais.org/blog if you want to download and read the article. In the very beginning of the article, you said that you wanted to limit your discussion to understanding awareness as it applies to functional integration and not dealing with its meaning in the context of awareness through movement. And I wanted to discuss that with you a little bit to kind of ask you why that was. Dealing with different types of awareness or...
Well, I'll tell you, in part because I thought I was going to have enough of an uphill struggle trying to lay out what awareness is to me in the context of functional integration, in which awareness has, for me, has to do with a practitioner coming to a state within themselves that somehow is open more to the experience of the other, so that they can form, I think we talked about last time, I'm not sure. Moshe certainly did. So what we can do is create a different kind of organism, an organism that essentially is constituted by the two of us. And so I thought that was going to be enough of an uphill struggle, and so I didn't want to get involved with awareness through movement because I have my own ideas about that also, in that the way I understand awareness through movement is that Moshe was trying to bring us to us. He wasn't trying to teach us movements. It wasn't the movements that were interesting to him. He was trying to teach us how to connect with ourselves, and particularly with an aspect of ourself or a dimension of ourself that I call awareness, so that he was trying to educate people to bring them to a state of awareness through movement. And oftentimes awareness through movement has become for a lot of people just a very sophisticated calisthenic. And the, what's really going on in awareness through movement is the process of developing awareness in a person from which the movement is secondary. Moshe always said that. He was really clear about that. That improving your movement is secondary. And that what improves your movement is learning to come to a state of yourself that's open for learning and in touch with yourself and so on. In any case, so I left out awareness through movement simply because I thought to make two cases was going to be really hard.
Yeah, well, anytime you start talking about awareness, it's kind of tricky. Matter of fact, I had somebody email me a few months ago, was asking if there was a awareness scale that I knew of somewhere so they could measure changes in awareness. I was like, I think that'd be really hard to do. So you said something interesting to me, which is why I sort of focused on that passage from your article. I think you used the words connect to yourself, or using awareness through movement to connect to yourself in a different way, because your article really focuses on some social aspects of functional integration. And when I'm doing awareness through movement, even though I'm lying down on the floor and ostensibly by myself, I still consider it a very sort of a social phenomenon.
Because of what?
Well, because I am relating to myself. You know, discovering perhaps a new movement, a new thought, some new breathing. I'm sort of shifting out of, for lack of a better word, you know, everyday consciousness. And I don't know, it's, just, it's like I'm taking time to be with myself in a new way. So I was thinking of that somehow being social. So I don't know necessarily where to go with that. But does that ring any bells for you, or does that sound...
No, it doesn't. But but something in the process of what you were talking about did ring a bell for me. Well, I know what it was. It had to do with, you said, you know, in the process of awareness or movement, you discover a different way of breathing a different way of moving, or you know, something new about yourself. What I think, it's kind of tricky there, I think, simply because I think you notice particulars in doing awareness through movement. If you're successful, you begin to notice particulars that are happening and changing. And, you know, you note them. Like, oh, my foot feels different there. I can do this. I couldn't do that before. But I think what's really happening and why there's that noticing is because very subtly you've shifted to a different state of consciousness. And it's that state of consciousness which provides the opportunity to notice the particulars. Unfortunately, the state of consciousness shows up for us as those particulars. So it's like the fact that there's something more general going on there, really profound and powerful, gets kind of obscured by the form it's taking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like if somebody said, asked you to kind of, for an understanding of what space is, and I don't mean outer space, I mean just space here, you know, the dimension that we walk and move in, and you were trying to show them space because we can't see it. You only see space when there's an object there. And so it's like, I don't want to go up the deep end here on a Saturday morning.
Not deep,
but my point is that it's easy. In order to demonstrate space to somebody, you have to start showing them objects.
You have to have a reference.
And it's easy. Huh?
You have to have a reference point?
Well, let me see if I can think of a better example. And maybe it's not even worth, you know, getting into this discussion because it may take us, you know, further afield than you want to go. But what I'm saying, though, is that I think that's why Moshe called what he did, I think, the elusive obvious
right. In
that book.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's something, you're trying to show somebody something that is a universal that can generate all kinds of particular actions and movements and thoughts. And that state, which let's say I'm going to call awareness, in which I think Moshe was trying to introduce us to, that state shows up as the particulars that we're learning or that fill it in any particular moment. And so it's easy to miss that itself, the thing itself. I guess that's not really very much clearer.
Yeah, well, no, that's fine. I just, you know, I'm just bringing up the point and that for me there's just something inherently social. Maybe it's social in the terms of a self-to-self relationship or a new way of relating to myself when I'm doing awareness through movement that mm-hmm. I thought was somehow similar to what you were describing when...
Let's come back to your notion of social then. So by social, you're not referring to your relationship to other people lying on the floor. You're referring to a relationship that aspects of yourself are having.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Although, you know, there's always, you know, a person, we can sort of be relating to a person or at least our internal image of them or sounds.
Right.
Even if they're not in the room. Or ourself in relation to how we were moving or thinking 10 years ago or when we first did a training or as children.
Mm-hmm. There's another thing that you just raised for me in thinking about what you're saying is that for me it was it always felt social to the extent that I wasn't free of carrying society and my thoughts about society and having to perform in front of other people just by standing there and being a person. I carried all that stuff with me onto the floor. So as I was moving around, there was still the issue of wanting to be better than I was before
mm-hmm.
and look better and be more impressive or whatever it is. And so there was me carrying that aspect of socialness into the lesson. And Moshe also would comment on that a lot, that, you know, people are trying to do, they're trying to get better, and that's not what the purpose of it was. The purpose was to lie there and just fool around and play like a baby.
Mm-hmm.
In a kind of systematic way. But I think also, by the way, you know, he was systematic in some of the things he did, but I don't, you know, if you picture Feldenkrais, for example, doing ATM, he didn't do ATM. I mean, what did he do, give himself verbal instructions?
Yeah, right.
I mean, and this is what I think the key difference is, he lay on the floor and actually had to get into and feel his body and feel what it was doing. And that led him into a lot of discoveries about the nature of awareness and consciousness and how we move and so on. And what happens now is people are following instructions that are being given, so they're not playing with themselves and developing the intimacy with themselves that Moshe had with himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was out of that intimacy with himself that he could develop a connection with other people in doing FI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've definitely felt that before. Because I, you know, I've got my computer here, and I record Alexander and I lesson and do them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been times I thought, no, wait a minute, why is it? As soon as I sit down, start listening to these instructions, I go into the state. You know, I should be able to just lay down and begin exploring and doing it on my own. So that might be another avenue of exploration.
Yeah. So, but when you put on when you start to hear the voice, it does something for you, or the tapes.
Yeah, I think so.
It puts you into a different state.
Yeah, or, you know, or at least having the words sort of guide my movement.
Right. So. Yeah. Well, see, I think that's part of it, that the words are useful for guiding the movement, because I think we've forgotten how to play. We're very busy trying to get better and to do things and so on, and we're kind of forgotten in how to play, like a child learns how to plays naturally, and that's why they learn so much. And I think what Moshe was trying to do is to reintroduce us to that, and the fact that he used movements to do that, I think, obscured the fact that it began to become what he was doing, teaching movement. But that's not what it was to him, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of something that my advisor, Alan Fogel, wrote, because he studies children. He talks about children discovering patterns of acting and thinking via their own activities, but they're not explicitly learning, nor are they following rules.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds somewhat similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. They may not be following rules. There may be some principles to how they're playing and doing what they're doing.
And you can come back later and describe what they're doing in sort of a rule-governed way.
Exactly.
But that doesn't mean they weren't following those rules when they were figuring things out.
Exactly. You see, I couldn't agree more. See, one of the things that this was a breakthrough for me in discovering this in relationship to my studying with Moshe was, sometimes, every once in a while, he would give an explanation of what he just did with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought it was very, very rare, much rarer than people think. But he would give an explanation, and you would get to see how he thought. And it was easy to think that the explanation that he was giving was what he had in mind as he was doing the lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And when I realized that wasn't the case, when he was doing the lesson, he was playing, he was exploring, he was creating, he was enjoying, you know, and just kind of taking risks and connecting with the person. And so he didn't have that blueprint in mind that he would give verbally after the lesson. And what I realized was that the explanation that he would give after the lesson was the reason why what he did worked. It wasn't the reason he did what he did. You follow?
So, yeah, very much so. I mean, they're almost like two different levels of description. I mean, the verbal description of what he did and what he actually did are two separate things.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's not, and because he would say, you know, he said, look, when I work with somebody, I rediscover the body all over again with them. I discover how a person works through them. He would also say, you know, that when he sits down to work with somebody, all his knowledge about anatomy and so on is there, but it's there in the background. Obviously, he didn't become stupid in the instance of sitting down to work. It was there in the background. It wasn't that which was in the forefront driving his action. I mean, he played. The guy was unbelievable to watch, making shit up.
One of the things from your article that we didn't get to touch on last week, things that are really cool to me because I play around with some of these things, and I did, you know, long before I came to the Feldenkrais community. Once again, I'll just use one of your quotes from the paper, which is, you're talking about the property of our consciousness to experience another person's experience directly, mm-hmm. and to know what is going on in someone else's body non-inferentially and non-deductively. And later mm-hmm. you say, you make the statement that you think it's possible to experience another person's somatic experience directly and feel them over there in their body.
Yeah,
I sort of take that for a given, that it's possible to do that. Although in your article, you seem to think that maybe that would be going too far for certain people in the Feldenkrais community, or...
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think it's far to go for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But it's a big step. I mean, usually the way we think is, and how we touch, let's use touching as a modality here, that when we touch somebody, the usual idea is that what we're getting is information about the person, the kind of like the firmness of the muscle and this and that, the information we're getting. And from that information, we formulate a hypothesis about what's going on there. That, to me, is what I consider to be indirect,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because it's put together from pieces of observation. Direct is, to me, and I think this is what we have the capacity to do, and it sounds like you agree, is to touch another person and to feel the pain that they're having in a place. But now we don't feel it in, I'm using pain also as an example, there's other things you could feel.
Sure.
And, And I'm not saying that we feel the pain in our body in the place where they're feeling it. What I'm saying is this: if Moshe is right, and I believe he is, that what FI is simply two organisms coming together and forming another organism, then if you've got an experience going on in your part of that organism, I should be able to tune into it, because at that moment of being one with you, it's part of my organism too in some weird way. Mm-hmm. And my nervous system has access to it directly, not indirectly as an inference. That's what I mean, and I believe it's possible. And the experience came to me, and I think I might have mentioned this in the article. I was at somebody's house a long time ago, a friend's house.
Yes, you did.
And their daughter was there, and you know, I put my hand on it and said, "It hurts here." And she said, "Yeah, but others would have said it was tight." And I realized it was true. I felt it hurt. So I really started to major in that. I realized I wasn't really smart enough to learn. You know, it was interesting. I would always feel like I should know more about the nervous system, how the nervous system works, in order to do my work better. And so I'd go out and I'd buy a book on the nervous system, and I'd read like about 12 or 13 pages until it started to get complex about the brain and so on, and then I'd quit.
Right.
And then about 6 months later, I'd go and buy another book about the nervous system. I went on for years like that.
Fits from my own experience. I wonder how many people out there that are Feldenkrais practitioners can go, yeah, I've done the same thing.
Yeah. And, you know, even if I understood the nervous system, what was I going to do with it? Because, you know, it was not like we've got a diagnostic system. If the nervous system was important, Feldenkrais would have taught about it, but he didn't. In any case, so what I finally realized is I can't improve my work by doing that, by taking that route. So instead, I had to somehow know what to do by connecting with the person's experience. And so I began to really focus on that an awful lot. You know, it's interesting. I add just one thing here that people may not know. After Feldenkrais wrote the book, I think it was The Potent Self, but I'm not sure if it was that one or another one. He was in Israel, and I read it, and it was a tremendous experience for me. It was just really wonderful to read what he was writing. And I wrote him a letter with a question. And my question was, he had said in our class on a couple of occasions that he could now do in one lesson what it used to take him 10 lessons to do. And that if he had enough time, which he didn't, but if he had enough time in life, he would be able to reduce what he now does in 10 lessons to one lesson in the future. And I said, what does he think accounts for that, given, and I structured it this way because I wanted to, if my structuring was too limiting, he would have let me know. But I just wanted to, so I said, given that, I don't think it's going to be the result of you learning more about how the body or the nervous system or cells or whatever work. In other words, what was making the difference in the efficiency, in his efficiency, was not more knowledge and information, but something, a shift in his own consciousness, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote me back a letter, and it's a letter I can actually, I could dredge it up here right now and probably read it to you. It's not a long letter. Would you like to hear the letter?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Oh, here it is right here. Great. Perfect. Let me make sure I get the whole letter. So in any case, he writes back, and I haven't, I'm not correcting his grammar, okay?
Okay?
He says, "Dear Marty, this is my first letter as I have recovered some smoothness in my writing." This was after his stroke. "It looked awful, trembling and almost unreadable. I like your letter for many reasons. Your question about the time reduction is answerable. It is increased efficiency by clarity and purity of action. FI is a sensory process of communication between two central nervous systems. A central nervous system can vomit in a few seconds, seeing blood, for instance. To take one into vomiting, even through hypnosis, is much longer. Acting, quote, properly, end quote," and then he puts in parentheses, "what is it, question mark. It is surprisingly effective." So now let me read that sentence again without my editing that. "Acting properly, it is surprisingly effective." And then he shifts to another topic that about some lesson that I had the pleasure of watching him work with a boy who had been drowned and underwater for about 20 minutes. And he says, "You remember the little drowned boy? Could you remind me his name? I intend to write one additional chapter in the case of Nora, and would like to remember his name, not for publication, for my own sake. Thank you for your letter. I am obedient and looks like I am going to stay with you. The surgeon, considered the best in the world for this sort of butchery, says people half my age could not recover faster or better. Yours as ever, Moshe. Huh. So in that, I mean, and that was the last communication pretty much that I had with him. I think so. Hold on,
so when you were talking about him, you know, doing in one lesson what used to take 10, mm-hmm. my mind immediately went to what we were just talking about, which was, I thought, well, maybe he's talking about being better in tune with the other person's nervous system, the other person, and being mm-hmm. able to sense and feel what they need.
Right.
But is that what he was getting to in the letter, or was it something else?
See, here's what I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I don't know the answer, so I ended up thinking, but whatever I ended up thinking about ended up being that which I felt was moving me the most. But I don't think I'm too far off. What I think he's saying is that, I always knew when watching him that he was getting information about the person directly in the way we're talking about, okay? So he would connect with the person and really feel what was going on with them and was able to put himself inside the other person and was astounding, the information that he had. What I think he's talking about in this letter in terms of directness of things and to change somebody and why what he wrote here is his attempting to answer my question about the reduction in time. What I think he's saying here is that if you really connect with a person, then your intention, and intention is a word I think that's grossly misused these days, but let me put it differently, your aesthetic sense of what's possible for this person, your client, that your aesthetic sense or vision, maybe that's even a better word, your vision of them starts to have causal consequences or it starts to manifest. In other words, you start to change them. None of these words I really like. You start to have an impact on them and bring into being a possible being that's over there with new capacities simply because that's how you see them. And what I think he's talking about here is exactly that. So we said, you know, if you see blood directly, you'll throw up. Even through hypnosis, it takes time to induce a trance and get a person deep enough so they can throw up. But he's talking about the direct experience of something. In any case, it was the direction I took it and where I've been playing. And these days, it's really kind of interesting. I'm really starting to get a sense, after a long time of playing with this, of the capacity, for not just the ability to feel another person's experience. I've had that for a long time. And I checked it out, and usually I'm pretty accurate when I ask a person about what they're feeling, and I have my own feeling about it. But what I'm starting to experience, and it's really exciting, is the possibility of impacting, I don't have any other words here, how a person is showing up, the manifestation, what's going on in their body, by seeing them differently. And it's kind of like what I started to say, and unless you have the experience, I guess it just sounds weird. It's just start to see a person into being. Now, if you watch, for example, if you watch Moshe in some of the Amherst tapes where he was given FIs, you know, that series of tapes. Mm-hmm. Okay. A lot of them, when you see him, when he's finished with a lesson, let's say, and he has a person walking around doing something or whatever, if you watch, you'll see it's like he's in the person giving instructions. The instructions he's giving, it's like he's giving them to himself somehow, like he's over there. And it feels like weird, like that somehow that he is moving the person from where he's sitting by his seeing them moving well or better than they are. And I don't like comparative terms like this. In any case, I always found a lot of evidence in watching him and listening to him for the view that I'm taking here. You know, do I want to die defending it? Not really, but it's been working for me.
Yeah, if it works, keep doing it. It's interesting to me because as you're talking, I can hallucinate that, say, people, students of Milton Erickson, people that have done Milton Erickson's work, or one of his students, Stephen Gilligan, would listen to what you're saying and would go, aha. You know, that's something that they believe or are able to do, at least they think they can do. So, and actually I just emailed Dr. Gilligan a few days ago, and I think he's going to come on here and talk on the podcast in a week or two. But he does this thing called deep trance identification, where through hypnosis, and not just, you know, it's an embodied sort of hypnosis, so where you're taking on someone's physiology, posture, breathing, and really trying to, well, I don't know exactly, there's all kinds of different intentions, I guess. But actually, and once again, this sounds pretty weird, but like actually trying to become another person, at least for a bit, that you can come to know, maybe use it for skill acquisition, or just have another another take on reality, or another take on another person's point of view. And I don't know if you want to go that far with it, but you do mention in your article a couple times that you're doing so without taking on the other person's sensation. And I was wondering why did you make that distinction, or what is that distinction?
Oh, yeah, that's great. I'm glad you asked. Yeah. The reason I made the distinction is because oftentimes one of the ways what I say is interpreted by people is that to feel somebody else's experience, they have to take it on themselves in their body. So if the other person has a backache, then they're going to start getting a backache. Also, a lot of people have come to me in workshops, and they've asked me that. They said, I seem to be affected by what a person comes in with. So I made that distinction because I like to educate people how to do what I'm talking about without it impacting you, except for the good.
Okay. So you think it can be done, but you're saying make it a choice point so you don't have to walk out with a backache or take
exactly.
On. Okay.
In other words, if you find, you know, the walking out with the other person's backache is possible. I mean, you can be impacted that way, but it's like if you start making finer distinctions with your own consciousness, you don't need to do that. For me, that's why I say I'm working with myself, but out there, it's in their body. It's one organism, but it's their part of the body. It sounds a little strange, and I have to keep apologizing for that because we're just not used to talking or thinking in these terms,
yeah.
I don't think.
Well, it's not strange to you or I, but just maybe to some people that would be listening to us right now. And so once again, this brings me, and we didn't really get into specifics about some of your workshops and trainings and things. Do you do specific thought experiments or lessons to try to develop this ability in people, or?
Yeah. See, awareness and movement is movement, working on yourself, and in a lot of workshops for advanced workshops for practitioners. A lot of people are teaching, you know, doing awareness through movement exercises or whatever you want to call them, and teaching FI and so on. So what I like to do is what I call awareness practices for practitioners. And these are some things that you wouldn't do necessarily with a client, because the purpose of them is to help develop the consciousness of the practitioner to be available to the world of the client. And so there's no reason why you'd have to teach that particular practice or awareness exercise to a client. So rather than doing awareness through movement, what I like to do is practices that are really going to shift the consciousness of the practitioner, rather than give them stuff that they can use with somebody else. What I want to do is really alter the consciousness of the practitioner so that if they learn to shift into that other mode of being, thinking, and so on, and perceiving and experiencing, then what they need is in that state of consciousness. And so to do that, I'm really interested in doing practices for practitioners. So, yeah, we do an awful lot of experiential stuff and hands-on stuff and things like that.
I'm having all these associations for different workshops and trainings that I've done in the past. So I'll be very interested in a couple of weeks when somebody else comes on, say, from an Ericksonian perspective or some other perspective, and see what the sort of similarities are. Well, those were the main points that popped into my mind as I was rereading your article. Is there anything on your mind that you want to?
I'd like to say also that there was a workshop I was doing in Ventura weekend of the 23rd of March, and filled up quickly. So I'm going to be doing another one the following weekend, also in Ventura area. The weekend of starting Friday the 30th of March. So I just would like to put that out there.
So we're talking Friday, March 30th. This is 2007. We're 3 days, is that right?
It's a 3-day, yeah, so it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
And how many people do you take on usually in a workshop?
It depends. It really depends on the size of the space and whatever, but it can be anywhere from 20 to 30. To me, it's large enough to be interesting and small enough to be intimate, and it usually works out well.
Okay. And people can contact you how?
My email is mweiner, W-E-I-N-E-R, at sbcglobal.net.
And then I will also have that on the website, on the blog. And then I have a feeling of these next few days and weeks, some ideas are going to bubble up that I'm going to want to talk to you about again. So I'm hoping you might consider.
Oh, I would love to talk. Yeah, I cherish the opportunity to share some ideas with people.
Yeah.
Because I think some of these ideas, like the elusive obvious, they're not really transparent. You have to work at them. And I know in conversation I had with Moshe, I know his feeling was that people would get it, and then they would lose it unless they had more contact with him.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of was able to keep alive the idea of not rigidifying or solidifying what he was doing into a system that became restrictive. It started to define what you could do and see and so on. He was much more interested in keeping it plastic and open. And because I remember once watching one of his earliest students work, and she had been a physical therapist and then came to train with him. And he watched her work, and he said to me, she hasn't seen me work for a while, and so she's reverted back to her physical therapy way of working.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really interesting that he felt. And, you know, because it was really what he said. It wasn't critical. It was just simply saying he was accounting for why he was seeing her not work in apparently her highest level. In any case, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree. And so then the question becomes, how do you get people to keep evolving into that new state or that new way?
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and I think it's nice to keep, you know, as a community, to keep talking about it because it keeps it alive. So listen, Ron, I appreciate it again. I always look forward to talking to you.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.